Welcome to the Precision Guided Podcast, the official podcast of the Georgetown Security Studies Review, where we cover all things national security, military, foreign policy, and history. Thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Nicole Butler. Today's guest is Jessica West to talk about space security. Who owns it? Who uses it? And how do we keep it secure? Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today. I personally like to start out all my podcast episodes by just handing the floor over to you to tell us who you are and what you do and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, it's a long story, so I'll try to stick to the gist. My name is Jessica West. I'm a senior researcher at Project Plowshares, where I head our work on peace, security, and arms control in outer space, which is really a governance file. We're really talking about how do we govern outer space in a way that maintains it as a as an environment that's peaceful for everyone to use. I got into this accidentally. There was an opportunity at Project Plowshares. It was an organization that I had long admired. My background was in peace and security studies, and there was no one at the time qualified to do their space work. So they were very clear during interviews that they were looking at second best options. And I guess I was second best. The rest is history, but it's been a really wonderful experience.
That's wonderful. I find the best things in life typically are the least expected when they arrive. For our listeners that have absolutely no background on space security whatsoever, can we start with just the biggest and broadest question of who owns space?
That's a great question. The short answer is no one owns space, which is a very good thing. Space is set aside in the Outer Space Treaty. It's called the province of humankind. It is a global domain free to access for all countries. And in theory, it is supposed to be used for the benefit and in the interests of all states and all peoples. So I think that's a wonderful aspiration. And, reality is always a little bit different than theory, but no one owns outer space. I think it's important to make that clear.
Okay. And so if no one owns it, how do countries or organizations and corporations go about sharing it, ideally?
Yeah. So sharing, another one of those aspirational words. Outer space has traditionally been a first come, first served domain, like a lot of global commons are. And so because it's free to use, there's really no global restrictions on who can use space or how, other than the fact that we cannot put nuclear weapons in outer space or military installations on the moon. But otherwise, it's free to access for those who can. And I think that's key. So for a very long time, only a handful of countries could access space. So sharing it was relatively easy. Today, I think there are, almost 100 countries in space. You'll have to double check on the number. It's a lot. It still continues to be used on a first come first serve basis. There are exceptions to that rule. Geostationary orbit, which is high up in space. It's the part of space where if you have a satellite, it hangs down over that particular part of Earth. So that lets us have great things like satellite TV. So it's really important for broadcasting to a specific geographic location on Earth. That has a special regime that is divvied up so that no states will be left out in the long run. But low Earth orbit, where we see most of the activity happening today, that really is a first come, first serve domain. I think right now we see that it's being dominated by private sector commercial actors, mostly because we have exciting new uses that are emerging, such as space-based internet. Capabilities to do all kinds of different imaging of Earth on a 24-hour basis. And that's kind of driving a lot of new activity and new objects being put in space.
Okay, great. I mean, I think that's wonderful that currently nobody owns space. That's a good place to be, I think. In terms of you talked about nuclear weapons, and there's a couple different elements that there are rules in place. You do a bit of work with the UN. Is that the primary organization or body that helps to establish these rules that are set out?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a lot of misperception about what outer space is like. So no one owns it, but it doesn't mean we don't have rules and we don't have governance. The core of space governance is the Outer Space Treaty, and that was drafted and adopted through the United Nations, and specifically through the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. That committee continues to be very active in setting additional rules and regulations for how we use space, particularly now that we have an explosion, figuratively, not literally, of activity in space. But there's really, I was going to say two sides to governance, but I'm going to say there's actually three sides to the governance of the UN. So it's kind of been divvied up. We don't have a Department of Space within the United Nations. We have the Committee on the Peaceful Uses. That has drafted the Outer Space Treaty, as well as the subsequent treaties that go into more detail about those core principles, such as liability and registration. But we also have the United Nations First Committee and the Conference on Disarmament. And these bodies are focused on that not so peaceful side of how we might possibly use outer space and trying to prevent those not so peaceful applications from emerging. Specifically preventing an arms race in outer space. And then there's another body, the International Telecommunications Union, and that governs how we use orbital locations and the radio frequency spectrum. So the natural resources of space that make it usable for us here on Earth. And so that is its own body. So there's a lot of rulemaking, a lot of governance, a lot of conversation that does happen. Even though we have kind of this perception of space being, a frontier or a wild west or an ungoverned space, it's simply not true.
Yeah, so there's a bit more order than I think we all kind of realize. What is the state of security and global governance in space right now, in your opinion? Where are we at?
Still not in a great space in space right now when it comes to geopolitics and security and global competition. Mostly that's a reflection of what's happening on Earth. So I like to point out, space is not separate from Earth. It feels separate, it feels far away, but it's very much entwined with everything that we do here. And that means it's entwined with our politics on Earth. As most people are probably aware, I think it's hard to read the newspaper and not have a sense of growing military and economic competition taking place on Earth right now. And space is very much embedded in that. The use of outer space is absolutely core to national security and military activities. And it's also core to economic competition and sort of the race for emerging technology and new capabilities, if you will. That means that it's a target. So there's more and more talk about states being willing to target other states in outer space, including possibly commercial operators if they're involved in war fighting activities on Earth. There's new capabilities being developed that are shady, if you will, that make other states uncomfortable. And that creates more tension in space because we don't know what they're doing or why. Or maybe we do and we don't like what they're doing and why. So the ability to approach other satellites, to get up close and personal with very sensitive capabilities that might be providing nuclear early warning and communications capabilities or intelligence capabilities. But also some of the more interesting and possibly helpful technologies that are being developed, such as the ability to remove junk from outer space, which could also be used to remove satellite from outer space. So I think we're in a really tense situation right now, where there's new users, new uses, new capabilities, and that's quite destabilizing at the same time that we have an ever-growing geopolitical competition that's emerging.
Interesting. I personally never considered, I guess, the parallels that would go on between what's happening on Earth and what's happening in space, but it makes sense because it's the same players, just different domains. But our podcast comes from typically the US foreign policy side, and you specialize on the Canadian side. So are the US and Canada strategic partners or partners at all in cooperating on space governance?
Yeah, I mean, I don't specialize in Canada, but I am Canadian, and I do have a good relationship with a lot of folks in the Canadian government here. So shout out, hi, they're great people. Canada and the US have a very close relationship on outer space, particularly on the security and military side, through structures such as NORAD, but also the Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance, NATO. So I think the two countries cooperate a lot and share a lot of data. That's a little bit different than the global governance side through the United Nations. There, the focus really is on the development of norms of responsible behavior. That's an initiative that the United Kingdom kicked off in 2020. But the United States is definitely a strong proponent and advocate and seeking to help develop those norms of responsible behavior. And I would say Canada is also very much in that boat. So, for example, the United States in 2022 kicked off a voluntary unilateral moratorium on the testing of destructive anti-satellite missiles in outer space, and Canada was the second country to join on and to be a part of that initiative. So I think there you see a close working relationship. Otherwise, Canada is not, I wouldn't call them a leader on space governance. And we
Yeah,
can get into
I was
that
going to
more.
ask actually a follow up to all of that is what is Canada's role? And I mean, there's a lot of talk about Canada being a middle power, and can they use certain domains to leverage their middle power? So what's your take on all of that?
Yeah, I mean, Canada has been changing over the years, and so has space. So I think once upon a time, when we at Plowshares first were getting into this topic way back in sort of the early aughts, if you will, Canada was really one of the leading voices advocating for arms control and non-weaponization of space. And I think that has shifted. But the debate on security has shifted and become more nuanced as well. So questions about non-weaponization are now broken down a little bit more, and we tend to be focused on this idea of norms of responsible behavior. I don't see Canada as the leading voice on this. I do see them as a helper. My perception is that they are striving to make discussions in UN bodies work at a really pragmatic level by bringing governance and legal expertise and practical ideas to make things smoother. So I have found them particularly helpful at the UN Open-Ended Working Group, where the norms discussion has been taking place. Just from a level of expertise that they're able to bring and explain, and I think engage in dialogue sort of across a whole bunch of different actors. Where I do see Canada leading, though, is on the topic of gender. So Canada is one of very few countries advocating for women, peace, and security, and gendered perspective to space security. It's something we haven't talked about a lot in the past, despite the fact that at the UN, this is a very big and important topic. So I think that bringing this perspective and this voice to the discussion is really important.
You mentioned norm building, and you've been a part of the process of norm building for space security. How does that work? How do you build norms? And is it easy? Is it difficult?
Norms are hard. I think there's this idea that because norms of behavior, which are social standards, expectations of what should be done, they're not legal agreements and documents. That makes them seem easier. They're not easier, they're just different. I think the starting point, though, is to really realize that norms grow out of what we already have. And so the first step has been taking stock of all of the different types of agreements that are already in place and thinking about, what do they tell us about how we should be acting? So in the Outer Space Treaty, we have core principles about non-contamination, due regard for other operators, being able to discuss and consult with one another if there's a dispute or a concern in outer space. And those provide building blocks for more specific behaviors that we can use to make space safer and more secure and sustainable for everyone. But really, moving forward on those requires ongoing engagement and conversation. Norms are social, and they tell us what kind of behaviors we expect others to abide by and that we also intend to abide by. And that means that we have to have an agreement on what those core principles are and what kind of actions we want to see in space. And I think that can take time. And it can also take time for those discussions to influence state behavior as well. So we can have discussions, we can put things down on paper. I think that's wonderful. That's the starting point. But then going back and implementing them at the national level, having consistency in behavior, that takes time as well. So this is not an overnight process. It's something that is ongoing. and has to be ongoing because our uses of space will continue to change, and so our actions will also have to continue to evolve over time with them. But hopefully those evolutions take place cooperatively, peacefully, and involve the whole international community.
Yeah, at the end of the day, norms are better than no norms at all, I suppose, which is
Well, we
fact.
can have bad norms. I
Oh,
think
let's talk
debris has
about
been
it.
actually yeah, so there's always norms in space, and I think there can be good norms and bad norms. So just because something is accepted doesn't mean that it's good. And I think we were creating a norm that said it's okay to test destructive anti-satellite missiles in space as long as you kind of try to mitigate the debris that is produced. But we know that there is no safe level of debris. We know that there is no safe destructive action in outer space. And so I think now what you see under the US leadership is an attempt to, steer that norm in a different direction and have a new norm that says, no, this kind of action is not okay. It's not safe. There's no way to make it responsible. And so the responsible thing to do is to not do it. So that's sort of norm emergence, bad norms, and an attempt to make a bad norm into a good norm.
So it's cyclical sometimes.
Sometimes,
How
yeah.
does norm building and the norms that are existed now, how does that affect the arms control in space and non-weaponization?
Yeah, this has been contentious at the United Nations. Some states don't want to have the discussion on norms. They only want to focus on a legal treaty that would ban weapons or the use of force in outer space. But norms are a really good way to help us get there. We already talked about the tense security situation in outer space right now. I think norms can help lower the heat on that situation. So if we have norms that demonstrate that potential dual use capabilities, those are things that could be used for helpful or harmful applications. So active debris removal might be one of those. If we have behaviors that we say, hey, this shows the international community that we're using this for a helpful or a peaceful purpose because we have done things such as notify the international community, coordinate with other operators nearby, launched in a way that is very transparent and safe. That can help to distinguish between hurtful uses and I think reduce some of the uncertainty in the space environment. Norms of behavior can also help mitigate the drivers of conflict, which are in turn drivers of potential weapons capabilities. So they can also turn down the volume on this sort of simmering arms race that we see unfolding in outer space. And then on that sort of helpful versus hurtful side, norms are a really important way to help identify what might be a potential weapons capability. So something that's not following what we would expect normal behavior to look like in space. And that might tell us that it is more threatening. And so I really see norms as core to the arms control discussion. Arms control itself is something that will take a lot of different tools, including verification, communication, dispute resolution, and norms. So I think we have a lot of work to do. That's a good way to say it.
Yeah, well, good thing you're there and you're involved because they need you. But to switch gears a little bit, I think for a lot of people my generation, when we think about space, we think about Elon Musk and Twitter or X and the privatization of space. And that's all the general public and people that are engaged on social media hear about. So, in your opinion, how does the privatization of space play into this broader discussion? Is it good? Is it bad? Are we all going to be in Elon Musk's space hotel in 10 years? What does the future look like?
All right, well, I'll go back to your first question and reiterate, Elon Musk does not own outer space and he will not own the Mars either. That's just not a thing and it's not going to happen. And some of that's a distraction. But also privatization of space or the growing private sector capabilities in space might be a better way to put it because there's no private ownership of outer space. It's both good and bad. It's changing the game. And so we have to keep up when it comes from governance. On the good side, I think, as you mentioned, it's doing a lot to bring public awareness to outer space. And that is so important. If we're not aware of outer space, if we don't value outer space, then we're not going to protect it. So I think that private activity is really helping to bring that awareness. It's also bringing a lot of new benefits. Can you imagine where we would be without the growing communications capabilities that the private sector is bringing? So internet as well as cell phone communications, these are absolutely essential for the whole world. Also, I have colleagues that are using space data to monitor human rights, and a lot of these Earth observation capabilities are also being driven by the private sector and the data shared by the private sector. Medicine advancements are being pursued in space. Manufacturing, things that we can't do on Earth, the private sector is trying to do in space where that orbital environment makes it easier and more practical. So I think there's a lot of exciting, innovative things happening, but we have to make sure that we maintain it as an environment that is sustainable, so we don't ruin the environment as we have in other domains. We're not necessarily good at protecting our natural resources and our natural environments. We have to cooperate so that the benefits are shared and we don't leave certain parts of the world behind in outer space. And we have to make sure that we develop capabilities and technology in a way that maintains peace. And I think that can be really tricky when there's a sense of racing and competition. And also, we might not have time to get into it, but commercialization of space is deeply entwined and happening at the same time as a big drive for militarization of space. And so those are also interacting with one another. Overall, though, it's a good thing. I think we have to focus on the positive and use that as a reason to engage in the governance, innovations, and practices that we need to not have the negatives.
I think that's a good perspective to have on it. And reassuring, I think, to my generation and below that it's going to be okay. It's not a bad thing. You mentioned a little bit about that we have not always as a human race taking care of our planet. And I think that's a big concern for, I mean, even me personally, studying international security and seeing data on the repercussions of climate change. So, what are the environmental impacts that are being considered within space? You talked a little bit about space trash and
Sustainability of the environment, in particular space debris, so those things that get left in space, have been a concern for a really long time, but they're more of a concern now, or at least there's greater awareness. And I think it's more pressing because we're putting more things into space. So what goes up doesn't necessarily come down, at least not right away. And so a lot of things that we put in space will stay in space. We have a history of derelict rocket bodies that have then exploded and created more debris. And those pieces of debris stay in space as well. And so I'm assuming a lot of people have seen the film Gravity, where you have this sort of cascading effect of junk in outer space that collide with one another and create more. So there is a real concern about the Kessler syndrome, this idea that we could reach a point where we have enough debris in space that could collide with one another that we would have a cascading effect. I think this is one of the areas where you are seeing a lot of traction when it comes to governance and new rules. The United States is certainly, I would say, at the fore of a lot of this. The FAA has been keen to put new regulations in place that would have operators deorbit their objects within a shorter time frame. So right now, the standard used to be 25 years, but if we're putting up thousands and thousands of satellites every year, we can't simply leave them there for 25 years. So they're creating new standards of 5 years. But I think that what's really exciting is the commercial sector is on board. They know that they can't operate if the environment is unsafe for them. If they are at risk of having their satellites damaged and where they have to maneuver all the time, that they're using a lot of fuel in space, which reduces the lifespan of their satellites. So they're really becoming, I think, key voices on this and on the forefront. And I think some exciting news we saw last week was voluntary initiative by SpaceX to actually deorbit, I guess actively deorbit. So to take satellites and lower them and remove them and have them re-enter Earth's orbit and burn up in space, which sounds terrible, but it's better than leaving things inoperable and at risk of collision with other objects. And so I think you see that initiative as a sign that this issue is taken very seriously and that who's using space is aware that they have a responsibility to make sure the environment remains usable both today but also in the future. I don't mean to keep rambling, but it's also a really exciting area of commercial innovation. And so you're seeing a lot of new initiatives within the commercial sector that are focused on the ability to remove junk from space. You know, I think prevention is key, but mitigation is also important, especially if we think about some of those old rocket bodies that might have fuel left on board, and over time they could explode and create debris. So I think there's a lot of exciting stuff happening on the sustainability front. But it doesn't mean that we don't have to continue to be focused on it and to keep trying to do better every year.
That's good. That's really, really good to hear. I'm gonna totally flip-flop to the other side and ask you, what do you think are the biggest threats to space security now?
Wow, there's a lot going on when it comes to security. I think broadly, growing military competition in space or the militarization of space is one of the greatest threats. I think we really are at risk of having sort of military confrontation or armed violence in outer space. I think that came to the fore last week when there were news articles talking about fears that Russia might be trying to develop a capability to have a nuclear weapon in outer space, which would be used to take out large swaths of satellites at once. That is one of the most dangerous ideas that I have ever heard in outer space. We know that it's dangerous. We know that it's bad. This is why it's banned. But this growing military competition, arms racing, I think is incredibly dangerous. And I think it's augmented by the state of governance in space when it comes to military activity. So the environment itself is not conducive to security. We don't have a lot of communication between operators and between states, and we don't have a lot of transparency about what's happening and what kind of things states are doing and the capabilities that they're developing. So that secrecy and opaqueness, I think, contribute to insecurity as well. In addition to nuclear weapons, which I'll be clear, there are no nuclear weapons in space. This is not an immediate threat. And it's something that states have long had a capability to do, which is why it's the core and kind of sole arms control provision in the Outer Space Treaty for now. But there's a lot of other harmful capabilities being developed, including directed energy, kinetic abilities, so other capabilities where you would physically harm things in space, cyber capabilities, jamming. There's a lot going on. There's a lot to unpack there. So I guess I have a lot that keeps me up at night.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but thank you for doing the due diligence. It's really inspiring to hear that states have had the capability to put nuclear weapons in space, but they have chosen not to. And I think, as someone who has spent quite a bit of time studying the trajectory of international security, that is a positive, and a bit of an anomaly. And it's very reassuring to hear that.
I think it's a choice we have to continue to make, and continue to commit to. We can't take those agreements for granted.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good point. You're headed to New York soon, and you're meeting with a group of governmental experts on the prevention of an arms race in outer space.
So the group of governmental experts, they had their first session of meeting in November. This is a closed process, and so it's a group that involves 25 states in closed door meetings, where the focus is to discuss ways to move forward on efforts to prevent weapons or the use of force in outer space. It's the second time that this effort has unfolded. The first one didn't end at consensus, so there was no final report that was released. The next round of meetings is in February, as you said, next week I'll be there. These are not formal meetings, to be clear. So this is an intersessional, informal meeting, and it has been opened up to civil society representatives. So I'm hoping to get a sense from states and from the chair of the process about how the discussion has been going, what the key issues are, if there's any areas of emerging consensus, or what the core challenges are in the discussion right now. But this is also the sole opportunity that civil society people, such as myself, and I have other colleagues who will be there, Victoria Sampson from Secure World Foundation. This is our opportunity to also speak to that group. And so to relay what our priorities are, what our ideas are for moving forward. I think, I guess, to have a voice. But my role is also, I think, to bring transparency to that process. So it is behind closed doors. That can be valuable. It can allow states to have more open and frank discussions without someone like me live tweeting what's being said. So it can hopefully reduce some of the performativity that can sometimes arise in very public, open conversations. But I think this opportunity to have an informal session and to have civil society representatives there also gives a chance to shed a little light on the discussions and bring awareness of what the key topics are and issues are to the international community. So I guess I see my role two ways, advocating on the one side in expertise, and then also bringing that conversation back to my colleagues in civil society, other states who might not be participating in these closed door discussions, as well as possibly the general public.
I think right there you exemplified the value of the cross-disciplinary approach that's being taken for cross-sectoral, I guess, approach. It's being taken for space security, so that's good to hear. What are you most hopeful about? Last question. We're going to be on the positive side of it, even though you've brought up many positive things. What are you most hopeful for regarding the future of space development, security, and governance?
Ooh, hopeful. On a really specific area, I'm hopeful that diplomatically, states are going to start seeing the value of having norms development and legal development happen in tandem with one another, and so not competing for different approaches to space security and governance, but pursuing a variety of different tools in complementary ways. At a bigger picture level, I'm hopeful and I'm enthused by the growing enthusiasm for space. I said earlier, we don't protect the things that we don't value, and we don't value the things that we don't know about. And I think that overall, there is really rapid growth and awareness about our space and how important it is, and its role in our future. And I think that that gives me hope. That gives me hope for sustainability, but it also gives me hope for peace. I think the more that normal people around the world see themselves in space, see themselves as stakeholders in space, that puts more impetus on efforts to maintain space as a peaceful domain. So thanks for having me on this show, because I think this is also part of raising that awareness and making sure that everyday people, as well as experts and experts working in, space tangent domains as well, are aware of what's happening and are aware of the stakes, are aware of how important space is, and are aware of the fact that it has to remain peaceful if we're going to continue to have the benefits that we have today. But also, let's reiterate, no one owns space, and Elon Musk does not own space and never will. Space is for all of us. And I think that is one of the beautiful things about it.
As a reminder, the views expressed on this podcast are the views of the participants alone and do not represent the views or opinions of Georgetown University, the Precision Guided Podcast, the U.S. government, or any other agency. Thank you for listening to the Precision Guided Podcast. Follow the Georgetown Security Studies Review on social media to stay up to date on the latest Precision Guided Podcast episodes and GSSR content. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Or you can visit our website at georgetownsecuritystudiesreview.org. Thank you to all our listeners out there. This is the Precision Guided Podcast, the official podcast of the Georgetown Security Studies Review.